Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Newspapers, broadcasters, and the online world produce a lot of noise when it comes to their coverage of politics, politicians, and our institutions of power. While the press, that is, plays an important role as a watchdog, significant ethical issues can and do arise in today's crowded media landscape. This will be the subject of a day-long conference at the University of Missouri-St. Louis tomorrow. It's the Center for Ethics and Public Life's second annual public ethics conference titled The Ethics of Politics and the Press. Joining me in studio are three participants. Award-winning journalist Jeremy Scahill is the keynote speaker. He is also the author of Dirty Wars. It focuses on clandestine global military activity. Lance Bennett is professor of communication and political science at the University of Washington. And Bill Freivogel is director of the School of Journalism at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank
Good
you.
To see you
Thank
all.
You. Good morning.
Lance, you've come the farthest, perhaps, so let me start with you. I'd like to get some very general reactions to you to the media landscape today. How well served do you think we are by today's media?
That's a good question. I think that what we are looking at is a situation of feast or famine. I think some people are extremely well served. I mean, I have more information at my disposal than I could ever have imagined even 10 years ago. I think a lot of other people are more or less left out. Their stories aren't being covered. Their communities are being neglected. But how all this shakes down to me is a very interesting question. I think the factoid of the month is $250 million. That is the amount of money that Jeff Bezos of Amazon paid Don Graham of the Washington Post for the Washington Post. What happens to the Washington Post will be a very interesting story. That's the same amount of money that Pierre Omidyar of eBay Billions has paid Glenn Greenwald.
That's not correct. I work on the. I'm a founder of that project, and that's totally incorrect.
It's not the same. It's not the amount of money.
No.
Well, what is the amount of money? Let's talk about that.
It hasn't been stated. That came up in an interview that Pierre Omidyar did, and said that he had been interested in purchasing the Post, and saying that he ultimately elected not to do it, and that he wanted to put his resources into building a totally adversarial media organization from the ground up. And Glenn Greenwald, myself, and Laura Poitras have been working on it with him from the beginning. And the interviewer inferred that he meant that he would spend $250 million, but Pierre never stated that he was going to spend $250 million more than that or less than that.
Well, let's tell our audience what this is all about.
Right.
I think it's a little inside baseball here. What is the reference point here?
Well, back to you.
Go ahead, Jer.
Yeah. So this is Jeremy Scahill, by the way. So a few months ago, I was in Rio with Glenn Greenwald, who, of course, is the journalist for the Guardian newspaper that has been the primary reporter who's been breaking the news of the NSA scandal as a result of the documents that Edward Snowden took and then gave to Glenn and Laura Poitras in Hong Kong. And Glenn and I had been talking with Laura for some time about starting our own media organization, not to replace the media outlets that we work with. I work with The Nation magazine. Glenn was working at The Guardian. Laura had a relationship at the time with Der Spiegel, the German publication. But the idea behind it was that there are cases where we were meeting resistance from established media organizations on stories that we were working on, and they would either try to water them down to a point where it wasn't relevant, or in our eyes wasn't relevant, or they simply weren't going to agree to run stories. So the idea at first was going to be if bigger established media outlets won't publish these stories, we'll create an avenue to do that ourselves, and it was going to we were going to basically put it on Kickstarter and start a fundraising campaign and maybe try to raise enough money to hire one or two people to work with us. Around that time, Glenn got an email out of the blue from a mutual friend of Pierre Omidyar, the founder of eBay, is saying that he wanted to talk to Glenn and myself and some others about potentially contributing to a new media organization that he wanted to build. And I mean, this literally happened like within days of us starting our discussions about starting creating this site. And so Glenn wrote him back, and we were on the phone with him talking. And basically, the three of us decided that we would work together in building this media organization. And Pierre said from the very beginning that he doesn't want to run the media organization, doesn't want to call the editorial shots, that he wants to build an organization that puts journalists at the forefront of making decisions in the operation. And so we've just begun the process of hiring people. And we're not hiring positions. We're initially hiring reporters, and we're going to build beats around them. And we're going to hire also younger reporters to be mentored by veteran reporters. And so initially, we're going to have a few areas of investigative journalism, but there hasn't been a dollar amount assigned to it. That was, and I'm not, I don't think it's your error. I think that it was something that was repeated over and over and over, which is in itself a commentary on how news travels in the age of Twitter and, you know, where first is better than right.
Okay, well, thanks for clarifying that. Lance, do you want to continue beyond the point where this came up?
Well, I'm curious if we can get a scoop here as to what the nature of this new organization might be. You said beats. What kind of beats? What is there beyond conventional beat journalism that you're thinking about?
Yeah, I mean, we're going to be announcing. I mean, just today we announced that that we've hired Eric Bates, who is a former senior editor at Rolling Stone and was the primary editor on the story that the late Michael Hastings did. That ultimately resulted in the retirement of General Stanley McChrystal, who at the time was running the Afghanistan War and the former commander of the Joint Special Operations Command. We hired Liliana Segura, who's an excellent criminal justice reporter, Dan Frumkin, who was formerly at the Washington Post and then ultimately at the Huffington Post. But I'm really not at liberty to say much beyond what already has been announced publicly, in part because we have a council of advisors, some of whom are very well-known figures within the world of the study of journalism that are helping us to shape the vision for the organization. But we're in negotiations with some very, very well-known big mainstream journalists, as well as journalists that no one's ever heard of that are really young, untapped talent.
Well, Bill Freivogel, I guess this conversation here is really indicative of the changing landscape that I alluded to in the introduction. Things are changing and changing quickly in many cases.
Well, they are changing very quickly. I think you had a program maybe yesterday on media literacy, and
exactly.
I think it's this is a perfect example of where we're going to have to try to create a great deal more media literacy for folks to be able to distinguish between the work of Glenn Greenwald, for example, and of reporters who adhere to professional journalism ethics of trying to maintain some sort of impartiality in their reporting. And Glenn Greenwald is an advocate of a particular point of view. And he's also done some excellent reporting. And I don't seek to diminish the importance of his disclosures, but he is not following traditional journalism ethics, and he's proud of it. I mean, he thinks that there was an interesting debate between him and Bill Keller, the former executive editor of the New York Times, on the Times pages recently, where they went back and forth on this particular issue.
Can I say something in response to that?
Sure.
Briefly? First of all, I think Glenn does follow journalistic ethics. And I mean, I would challenge the notion that the New York Times regularly follows journalistic ethics. I mean, the fact is that when the U.S. had a spy in Pakistan named Raymond Davis, who shot and killed two people in Lahore, Pakistan, the New York Times discovered that he, in fact, was a CIA contractor and continued, knowing that he was a CIA contractor, to report that he was a diplomat at the embassy who was essentially a passport stamper. This isn't a case of them not knowing exactly who he was. It was that the government said, we don't want you to report that he's CIA. Fine, I understand that. But instead of simply saying, okay, then we're going to leave it vague, they took what the government wanted for propaganda value and promoted an entirely false story. The New York Times allowed its pages to be used as a conveyor belt for the lies of the Bush administration leading up to the Iraq War. So, you know, when you're going to hurl around the phrase traditional journalistic ethics and then, you know, put it as the debate is between Bill Keller and Glenn Greenwald, I would question Bill Keller's ethics. Also in how he handled the WikiLeaks story. They totally threw their sources under the bus there and engaged in a smear campaign after using WikiLeaks to sell newspapers. So, I mean, to me, there's a real debate about what journalistic ethics even are. I don't think that large corporate media outlets actually are the sort of golden, you know, cow of objectivity. I don't believe there is a such thing as objective journalism right now.
Well, I would just say, if I may just say in response, I mean, I don't know the details of the particular Pakistan case that you talked about. And I don't defend what the New York Times did in their journalism, Judith Miller's journalism in the run-up to the Iraq War. I thought that was a very poor job of journalism. And I think Bill Keller eventually apologized for that. But I do think that, I mean, traditional journalistic ethics, the journalistic ethics that are ascribed to by professional journalism organizations do include an attempt to be impartial, objective, to put aside one's personal feelings. And I know this is becoming – and one of the changes in the landscape is this is becoming something to make fun of or thought to be passé. And I happen to think it's important because if you look at Greenwald's reporting, I think it's – I mean, it's very clear – his opinion and his public statements about his reporting – it's very clear that his opinion affects what he says. I mean, he says these are clearly illegal and unconstitutional surveillance by the NSA. It's not at all clear. And it's been approved by – most of these programs have been approved by all three branches of the government. So I think his advocacy reporting affects what he writes.
Is James Risen of the New York Times an advocacy journalist?
I know him a bit. I wouldn't make that claim. I don't know enough to – I mean –
if you saw his recent appearance on CNN, he sounded exactly like you're describing Glenn Greenwald. And I mean this is the thing. I think there's a double standard and people say, well, you know, because Glenn Greenwald expresses his opinions in this way that somehow that makes him have a poor relationship with the truth or with the facts. And I simply disagree. I think there's a lot of advocacy journalism. It doesn't get labeled as such because it advocates on behalf of the state.
Do you want to get in on this?
This is Lance Bennett. I think this debate – is exactly where we are today with ethics and news standards. And I commend the listeners to go back a couple of weeks and read that debate between Keller and Greenwald because it was a much more developed version of this discussion. Here's what I think is going on is the legacy press, the New York Times, the Washington Post, whatever it may become, has established relations with mainly official government sources over years and cultivated those sources. And there's been a conflation of objectivity and political power. So that basically those who are in power and in positions to determine outcomes like invading countries or deciding bills in Congress have the loudest voice in the press. Now, they may not always be exercising good judgment, as we know from various kinds of government failures. And I mean, the American people are not happy with their government these days. But the establishment press has been positioned to report what officials say. If democracy is off track, most Americans think it is, then that leaves the conventional press with some soul-searching to do. And the apologies that came after the Iraq War by all the major papers, with the exception of the McClatchy Group that kind of got it better, were well-meaning, I guess, because they look so bad. But the point is that when the next big scandal came along during the Iraq War, the Abu Ghraib and the torture issues that became important to challenge the values of the American democracy, the press reported the Bush administration lying again. I mean, it was a report as an isolated case of unfortunate abuse on the part of a few poorly trained soldiers and contractors. And so the whole issue of torture did not come up in the U.S. press, importantly, until after the 2004 election in which John McCain turned on his own president and said, if you don't fix this problem, I'm going to lead a majority in the Senate against you. And that's how power works in objective journalism. And I think that if we don't sort that out, objective journalism is going to find itself looking much into the rearview mirror of history and not catching up with whatever you want to call it, advocacy journalism or simply truth.
If I could hold that thought, if you will, Bill, we have to take a break. We'll come back, and there are lots to talk about, obviously, and no shyness on the part of the panel in doing the talking, I must say, which is very good for our program here. With me in studio, journalist Jeremy Scahill, Lance Bennett, professor of communication and political science at the University of Washington, and Bill Freivogel, director of the School of Journalism at SIU in Carbondale. We'll continue our conversation on ethics and the press, the media, in just a moment. We'd like to get your input as well, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. And, of course, we will take a tweet at STL on Air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again. Welcome back. Bill Freivogel, I stopped you before you could start. Go ahead.
Well, just to make sure that I'm the odd man out here and sort of the apologist for the establishment media, I'd like to take on Lance's vision of the establishment media as the corporate media as parroting or being sort of patsies for the official government line. I mean, I think that would be a very much of a surprise to public officials who I mean, if you listen to Jay Carney answer the questions in the White House press room, I think it would be a surprise to government officials to think that this is actually a popular theory that's advanced in academia. It's a very much of a surprise to myself when I left the St. Louis Post-Dispatch after 34 years to discover that most of my colleagues at the College of Communications saw the corporate media as being just, you know, parroting or conveying what the government and the establishment had to say, because I'd spent 34 years challenging what the government had to say and never had anything censored by the Post-Dispatch. So I just challenged that entire sort of notion of the role of the establishment media.
I think the public might disagree by virtue of what they see, for instance, on television, particularly cable television, because that's a totally different ballgame. There's not a lot of objectivity there. And I think that has clouded the way a lot of people feel about journalism today.
Well, I mean, I monitor cable television pretty closely. I mean, I should just say by way of background, I spend most of my time reporting outside of the United States. Mm-hmm. The past 3 years, I was in Afghanistan, Yemen, Somalia, reporting on covert U.S. military actions or the role
soft
of the CIA.
Assignments,
soft
obviously.
Assignments, right. But I remember we were talking about the Abu Ghraib situation. I remember watching the morning that was breaking out into the broader world, and Barbara Starr, who is the CNN Pentagon correspondent, I often call her the Pentagon spokesperson who flirts with the idea that she's CNN's correspondent because she truly sounds like a spokesperson for the Pentagon. She said the real scandal here is who actually released these photos, because that's illegal. I mean, with no sense of what of the sort of irony of it. And regularly, she will report as fact statements that officials have made to her without calling into question any of their assertions. And those of us who are in the place that she's there in the Pentagon, we're overseas, we're seeing something very different. And we watch her. I mean, I've watched New York Times journalists laugh their butts off watching this person at the Pentagon reporting, quote unquote, for CNN. These corporate media outlets, these cable news outlets, it's like infotainment. And they have all of these retired military people on their payrolls. These people were going regularly through the Bush administration to the Pentagon to receive these secret briefings. Many of them are on the payroll of big private contractors that are making a huge amount of money off of these wars. And they almost never disclose their financial relationship to the very conflicts that they're brought on as military experts to discuss.
Have any of you read the book This Town by Mark Leibovich?
Yeah. Parts of it.
Yeah. It's worth reading because it really relates to a lot of what we're talking about here today. On the issue of national security, what should the role of the press, the media, be with regard to national security issues? I mean, it's national security we're talking about. If you have the information, do you broadcast it? Do you print it or not?
Well, I think you do. And I think the role of the press is to report important information it receives regarding U.S. national security actions, and to report that whether or not the information is information that was classified and therefore the release of it by a government employee was a crime. It's still the press's job to report that. I mean, take for example the Pentagon Papers, or take for example the Snowden disclosures in relation to the NSA data gathering. So, I mean, I have a little trouble. I have trouble squaring the circle in that I think that the government has the right to protect its secrets and to prosecute Snowden. But I think that the press has not only the obligation and the right to publish the Snowden's disclosures.
Prosecute Snowden, but not Greenwald.
That's right.
Okay.
Although Greenwald, I would point out that Greenwald – I surmise, and maybe Jeremy can correct me on this, but I'm beginning to surmise.
Don't ruin it. I was just starting to agree with you.
Oh,
on that.
Okay.
All right.
Maybe I should stop.
No, that's all right.
But I don't think Greenwald should be able to be prosecuted. But I have noticed that it seems like maybe Greenwald is conveying Snowden's documents from country to country, and that is sort of an uncomfortable for me as a traditional journalist. That becomes an uncomfortable kind of situation that can get a little bit on the border of, you know, becoming a co-conspirator in the original.
Let's unpack that. I intellectually don't even understand what you're saying. Glenn Greenwald, the only thing that he's done with regard to Brazil, Spain, Germany, France, and maybe one or two other countries is he has never been the source of documents for a publication. He is that on an article where he does not have a byline. He is reported for major international publications alongside journalists from those countries. So I don't I don't understand what your point is there.
Well, I agree that wherever he is the reporter on the story that, that he should not be able to be prosecuted for that. I just have noticed that some of the I believe that Snowden no longer has documents with him.
What he said publicly is, yeah, he didn't take any of the documents to Russia.
And it seems as though some documents may be going from place to place.
I don't know if I'm speaking out of school here about, I mean, I don't know if Glenn would be irked with me for saying this, but I mean, I actually know quite a bit about this, and the documents are being held in an incredibly secure manner, and no one is being handed individual documents under any circumstances. When Glenn is working with a major publication from France or from Germany, those journalists go to Rio, where Glenn is living right now. And they do not have access to a trove of documents. They are working only with the documents that relate to the story that they're going to be reporting on. And the documents are never handed to another news organization in that manner, especially when if Glenn is not the, the reporter on the story. That, to my knowledge, has never happened.
Lance, how do you approach this subject with your students?
Well, I like to go back to the question of democracy in the press and the question of journalists feeling, and most journalists do feel that they are competing for information, that they're being antagonistic, challenging to public officials, and all of that is true, but the question is what comes out at the end? And that's a different story. So the feelings of journalists should be separated from what they actually produce. And what they produce is determined by the trail of power on a particular issue. So if power is divided, Congress is having fights, the administration and factions in Congress are you know challenging each other, you get democracy on the front pages. You get a spectrum of ideas with different voices and different viewpoints, maybe not the full spectrum, but you get something that we would like to see in a competitive press system. When there is a dominant position, for whatever reason, that and the Democrats, for example, didn't challenge Bush on the war, just as they didn't challenge his father on the earlier version of that war, then what you get is one point of view. Even though there is information outside the spheres of power in Washington that might challenge that point of view, and my complaint about the press and my sense of the American people's complaint about the press is that we often don't hear about that other information. And I could give you lots of cases where it existed at the time that stories were being reported from a dominant point of view, that when we don't hear it, people feel disillusioned that their system isn't working. And the press is, for all practical purposes, a branch of government. Not a formal one, of course, but without the press, we don't have a governing system that works very well. So I think that back to you, I can show you lots of evidence where no matter how much competition there was in the press and how beleaguered reporters sometimes feel in their dealings with officials, the end story is not what it could have been, and that's where the journalism today ought to focus its values question.
I wanted to agree with Bill on something, though, just to make this
news right there.
You know, I mean, I do have a very sharp critique of the – I don't mean sharp like I'm intelligent. I mean sharp like I'm harsh on the corporate media. But I also think that some of the best reporting that's happening on any given day around the world is being done by journalists who work for huge news organizations. Matt Apuzzo and Adam Goldman, who won the Pulitzer Prize for their reporting on the New York Police Department's relationship with the CIA and wrote an excellent book on that subject, are top-notch reporters. Adam Goldman just went to the Washington Post now. I have tremendous respect for them. Charlie Savage of the New York Times, one of the best investigative reporters, who would be stunned if anyone said that he was a stooge for the state or for the government. I mean, you can list all these people. Arwa Damon of CNN is one of the best. She's one of the best combat reporters in the world with a nuanced understanding of multiple Islamic countries, and she reports under great, great stress and danger. But at the end of the day, I also agree that you have this relationship between the leadership of some of these big media organizations and the national security state where deals are made not to publish stories. And to me, that's a huge part of the problem. Or when powerful officials are able to essentially snowball an editorial process. We have an administration in Bush and Obama. They are addicted to overclassification and to secrecy. And that's a huge part of the problem. There are things that are classified that should not be classified. I hear this all the time from people in the intelligence community. And when you have a Democratic president who won the Nobel Prize, who's a constitutional lawyer by training, who actually is using the state secrets privilege to try to quash legitimate lawsuits, when journalists are being named in indictments, when James Risen is in a situation, this New York Times reporter, where he may go to jail, and this case may go to the Supreme Court, if he doesn't testify against one of his sources, that sends chills across the whole journalism community, whether you work for Disney Corporation or you are blogging online.
Let's go to the phones. We have lots to talk about and lots of people in our listening audience who want to be a part of it. And we'll start with Mike. He's been waiting on us for ever since the beginning of the program, and he's on a cell phone. Go ahead, Mike.
Gentlemen, I appreciate your comments. The only thing I've got to say, basically, as a member of the public, not one of you media folks, is that, looking at Glenn Greenwald, something comes to mind, and I think it was called yellow journalism. I think Mr. Greenwald basically exemplifies everything that is bad about journalism. He's obviously leaking these documents out in small increments. He's not, leaking these documents out in a large, broad sense. He just simply is saying, here, I'll call this person this week. And by the way, my story's died down now, so I'll call this person this week. That smacks of yellow journalism. It smacks of basically making the story instead of, he wants to be the story instead of making the story. Quite frankly, as a member of the public, when I go to Flipboard, when I go to basically look for my news sources, everything now that The Guardian prints, I take with a huge, huge grain of salt. Because, quite frankly, Mr. Greenwald, who is publishing from a third world country where he has no access to any repercussions from anybody else, has tainted, and Ms. Poitras, by the way, as well, has tainted our view of what a journalist should be.
Mike, thank you much for making this call. Who would like to respond? Jeremy, I think you probably
I guess I'm kind of take that one. Yeah. Well, I mean, I sort of heard contradicting things, and I think Brazil would be very the most powerful economic power in Latin America would be very shocked to hear that it's a third world country. But to take on the content of what the caller said, he's saying it's yellow journalism because Glenn Greenwald hasn't just thrown all of the documents online. Presumably, the caller has no problem then with Glenn putting on documents that have names of U.S. agents that would be exposed around the world. I know Glenn has a huge problem with that. And it's why these documents are not just being thrown up on the web for everyone to search. There's a very careful process that involves national security lawyers, media lawyers, and consultation with government agencies who are affected by the release of these documents. And there has been a very rigorous, serious process that was implemented once The Guardian started to publish these stories. That actually has been the subject of much internal debate at that organization, with some people saying you're deferring too much to the government and other editors saying, we need to consult more with them. This happens at The New York Times, The Washington Post constantly. I think there's sort of a misunderstanding of if you look at what Glenn has done when his articles are published in the news section of The Guardian, there is no opinion whatsoever in them. Glenn, of course, is a very opinionated guy, and he will also write commentary pieces. That's been the subject of controversy. But when Glenn does a piece of journalism that is based on these documents, it is not the Glenn Greenwald opinion show. It is all of it has been researched, sourced, legally reviewed, and edited by a very serious editor.
I think I would agree with most of that, and I think that when the Glenn Greenwald is appropriately, as the New York Times and Washington Post do, trying to make sure that the names of, say, agents are not published in a way that would threaten their lives. It's something that, for example, Julian Assange, I don't think, did very well in the WikiLeaks situation, and one criticism of him for that. In defense of the caller, I think maybe the caller's point was that it seems as though, and I would make this point personally, that it seems as though the stories are being and the documents are leaking out in a way as to maximize the damage to U.S. national and diplomatic interests, so as to they're being leaked at propitious moments to successfully embarrass the United States. And maybe that makes the journalism more powerful. But I think maybe that was a point that the
that seems to be quite a value judgment you just made. I mean, to embarrass the United States, well, or to raise an important question to public attention, world attention, and keep an important story going. One of the caller's points was that Glenn Greenwald seems to be trying to keep the story going. Well, if it's a big story, he should keep it going. One of the failings of the legacy press is to wait for officials to do a next thing to keep a story going. I once talked to Bill Keller on a panel some years ago about the Abu Ghraib torture scandal and asked why the Times and the Post didn't keep the story going. He said, well, because it died down in Washington. There weren't congressional, you know, they had hearings and then they put it to bed. Well, but is that the end of the story? When activity in Congress dies down, then you don't have anything more to report, even if there's evidence that these things are happening all over the world and the U.S. is doing them. So how do you keep a story going? I mean, that's another way of thinking about what Greenwald is doing. I just want to, you know, put that out there as well.
I mean, we traditional journalists do a pretty good job of trying to keep our big stories going. So it's not something that's one kind of journalism or another, I think, has a monopoly on.
Difficult to do in today's 24-hour news cycle and the short attention span that the American public seems to have. Let's go back to the phones, and we'll bring in Jeff calling from St. Louis. Jeff, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I like Bill Freivogel. I appreciate his contributions on the legal roundtable. I want to take exception with his argument that the mainstream journalism doesn't do the government's bidding. And in local context, Sylvester Brown and others have accused the Post-Dispatch of having too comfortable a relationship with the mayor and of keeping stories quiet or putting a spin on stories in the mayor's favor. Sylvester Brown and his supporters maintain that he was forced out of the Post-Dispatch because of his critiques of this relationship. And I can listen to your answers on the radio.
Okay, but you're going to have to wait for 1 minute for that because, once again, I have to take a break, and we'll do that now. Come back and continue our conversation on ethics and the media. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back. If you're enjoying our discussion on ethics and the media, you can have more of it tomorrow. UMSL Center for Ethics and Public Life presents the second annual Public Ethics Conference titled The Ethics of Politics and the Press. It's a day-long conference being held at UMSL's Millennium Student Center tomorrow from 8:30 a.m. to 4:40 p.m. We have more information about that on our website, stlpublicradio.org. It is free, and you, the public, are welcome. But check out anything you might have to do to register on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to Bill Freivogel. Go ahead, Bill. Sorry to have interrupted you.
On Sylvester Brown. So I like Sylvester Brown, and I like also the people who I think Sylvester probably thinks at the Post-Dispatch.
1 minute. Just want everybody to know that Sylvester Brown, formerly with the St. Louis Post-Dispatch.
Right.
And is no longer.
A former columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and a former colleague of mine there. And I'm also friends and former colleagues of the people he probably thinks are too close to the mayor's office. And I have a great deal of respect for both of them. I don't think Sylvester I was forced out of the Post-Dispatch because of his critical view of the mayor's office. I think it was more there was actually an ethical issue raised about in connection with a conference he was involved in, and he made a good defense of himself. But the Post-Dispatch thought it violated their ethical rules, and that was the end of Sylvester Brown. Back to the sort of general issue. I don't want myself to be overly simplistic, and there's no question but that oftentimes the media, and this oftentimes may be the New York Times and the Washington Post that are closest to the centers of power, are too willing to abide by the government, by are not challenging enough to the government line. The run up to Iraq war is a good example. I mean, I felt at the Post-Dispatch I felt quite. Quite alone, you know, along with the folks at McClatchy and a colleague of mine at the Post-Dispatch, John Sawyer, in challenging Secretary of State Powell's presentation to the United Nations and opposing the run-up to the war as being based upon bad intelligence. And so there was too much credence given to the government line. And certainly a lot of newspapers, particularly small newspapers, are too willing to abide by their advertisers' desires in what they publish about local affairs. So it's not at all simplistic, but I still think we have a very strong traditional press that challenges the government's line.
You asked about cable news before. I mean, if you look at the options right now of the major cable news networks, I mean, what's really interesting now is that Al Jazeera now is actually going to be on real cable in the United States with their new channel, Al Jazeera Americas, which I actually think is not as good as Al Jazeera English, which is their global English language news program. But that's a different issue. But when you look at MSNBC, and I go on MSNBC quite a bit, and I'm shocked that they still let me go on because I criticize them openly on their air. I actually said on MSNBC's live airwaves that their coverage of the Democratic National Convention looked like one big Obama for America meetup. Mm-hmm. And I think it's basically what state media would look like if Obama could choose how to have a news station structured to support his administration. Then Fox News is like a parody of itself. They don't need – Saturday Night Live does not need to parody Fox News because they do an effective job of making fun of themselves without even being aware of it. And it's like the scary black Marxist Manchurian candidate is going to take your guns away and make Chairman Mao rise from the dead and become president of the United States. And then CNN is just milquetoast in the middle. And so I think a lot of people feel like they don't have anywhere to go unless they want to be part of the partisan ping pong there or be bored to death.
You don't think Chris Matthews actually did have a tingling feeling in his leg when he was
– I'm sure he regularly gets tingling feelings when he's sitting with some of these Democratic politicians, as much as some of the people on Fox News probably can't wait to give Ted Cruz a big old kiss. I mean, it's like
– part of the problem is that these people then walk out of the studio, then walk off to a party or a dinner or someplace with these very people. And that's problematical for me because they're very, very cozy and close to a lot of the people they're covering. Oh, yeah. And that even if there's no ethical problem there, it certainly gives the illusion of the impression of that. I had a question for you. We're having some listeners who are having trouble understanding what advocacy journalism is.
You'll get three different answers from us.
Okay. Yeah, I think there isn't much agreement on what that is. And I think Bill's point about Glenn Greenwald trying to make the government look bad, I think is kind of misreads what advocacy journalism is. It's kind of trying to bring as much evidence to bear on important questions as possible and pushing those questions. I mean, should the U.S. government, a democracy of sorts, be spying on its own citizens and foreign leaders who are allies and so on? Those are big questions. And should the U.S. be using torture in its war against terror? That's a huge question. I mean, it's a fundamental value question for this society to confront and for citizens to grapple with. And you know, we don't invite citizens to grapple with enough of these kinds of questions. For me, back to your question, the focus of advocacy journalism is to find the big questions of our time that need to be addressed, not just by the elites who are having, you know, deliberations about these things, but by the publics who really often don't understand what's going on much of the time, and to keep those questions in public discussion long enough for people to begin sorting out their own value positions as citizens in this society.
Jeremy, do you have a different definition?
No, I largely agree with that, but I also think, I mean, there have been Pulitzer Prize-winning news teams from local newspapers around the country that have done exposés, for instance, on the chocolate industry. And I mean, when I was working in radio, I would interview these people, and they were passionately advocating for the rights of the people who were affected by the way that chocolate ends up in our Easter baskets or in the Christmas stockings, because they were being abused as workers, or people that have reported on the Chiquita Banana Corporation and its role in Latin America, or the Coca-Cola Company, and it's the garment industry. And I think that there really is advocacy journalism there, and you talk to these journalists about their stories, and they are advocating for those people. And I think that there's a weird sort of disconnect between advocating in those kinds of stories and then advocating for basic civil liberties or against wars that ultimately undermine our national security or result in large numbers of civilians being killed or young men and women from America being put in uniform and sent to wars that are pointless at the end of the day. I ultimately think that we should do away with this idea of objectivity as a sort of course of academic pursuit in journalism. To me, the most important components of good journalism are transparency, and honesty, and is your is what you're providing to the public actually in the public interest? I really don't think anyone. We're not robots. I think we've created a sort of mythical perception of what objectivity is, and I often think that it's just a sort of a cover to obfuscate reality.
I would agree with Lance saying that the big questions of is the government surveilling us too much and invading our privacy? Are we going off to foreign wars that we shouldn't? Are we torturing prisoners in the war on terrorism and calling it by some other name? Those are all questions that are the starting points for a traditional journalist as well as an advocacy journalist. Here's the distinction I make is that when you're talking about a Glenn Greenwald. Not only does he
should we get him on the line here?
Yeah, let's get him on the line. does he report his story, but then he goes on all sorts of makes all sorts of public statements in which he expresses his opinion that what he has just reported is not only is so extremely important, but it's also clearly an illegal government surveillance program.
Bob Woodward doesn't do that.
Bob Woodward is sort of a – I'd say he was a professional journalist who tried to in general abide by professional journalism ethics. But I would agree that his books come to – his books and his investigations
come to conclusion. He pontificates on the Sunday talk shows and expresses great opinions in defense of the powerful and at times makes statements that get him in trouble, where he lets something out of the bag. I mean, I think what you're saying feels like a little bit of a double standard where, Glenn Greenwald all of a sudden becomes this horrid example of advocacy journalism, and someone like, Jim Risen, who says the same things, somehow gets off scot-free. And I like Jim Risen. I actually think Jim Risen's doing great journalism, and I love when he's on television expressing his opinion because I trust his journalism.
I mean, I think journalism and democracy need both the Glenn Greenwalds and the Bill Kellers and Woodward as well. I'm not trying to run any of them out of the journalism community, but I do think that readers need to know that what they're getting is something different when they're reading something that is written for the news pages of the New York Times as opposed to Glenn Greenwald's pieces in The Guardian, because Glenn Greenwald is starting with a preconception and he has a particular opinion which he expresses in great eloquence and detail about that. And it just doesn't – I mean, I as a reader don't necessarily feel as – I'd like the reporter who starts out on an investigation to not start out with preconceptions that he then goes about finding proof of.
I mean, I would argue that many reporters who are working in Washington start off from the preconception that that there should be some sort of deference to the state. And I was mentioning before, I think there are a lot of exceptions to that. I just think that when it's someone who's challenging state authority, they become an advocate journalist. When it's someone whose default position is that those in government probably are generally telling the truth about these things when they give us anonymous tips, then they somehow are not advocacy journalists.
Back to the phones. And the limited time we have left, we'll bring in Jay calling from Normandy. Go ahead, Jay.
Yeah, hi, guys. I'd be curious to know your guys' opinion about the PBS NewsHour and how straight up they play their news. I think they're very good. And I'll just rattle off a couple of reporters that I particularly like. Richard Engel, Laura Logan, Martha Raddatz, John Miller, John Byrne. And I think all those guys report pretty straight up. And locally, I'd be curious to hear what you all thought. Some of our radio stations, particularly 97.1 and KMOX, act like they know the news more than the Post Dispatch. My gosh, in my opinion, the Post is the news leader for all these guys, and they just piggyback off the Post. And one last area
Bill's
is
brother.
Climate science, where 97% of climate scientists say global warming is real, it's happening. I believe the LA Times now doesn't accept these contrarian views that are out in la-la land. Your comments.
Hey, okay, you've given us a lot to chew on here. I think you started with the PBS hour. Let's not go down the long laundry list.
I generally agree with his positive appraisal of those journalists and news operations. I think KMOX has, I hate to. Do we want to criticize one of your competitors at any rate? But when they have, you know, when they have opinion after opinion after right wing opinion through the day, it's a little bit hard to know, you know, what to see any kind of balance there.
And we know that radio stations and television stations, to a very large degree, all over the country, use the local newspaper as their source,
right.
Their primary source for news. He mentioned the name Lara Logan. Now, she has made a little news herself. as you know, how much damage do you think has been done to her and 60 Minutes and CBS by this story that she covered that was totally bogus?
Just to clarify for people about the siege of the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, where the U.S. ambassador Chris Stevens was killed. And then
thank you for doing that.
CBS did a story on 60 Minutes 2 weeks ago with someone who alleged that he had been involved with the response to it. And it turns out that many of the things that he said on the airwaves of 60 Minutes turned out to be utterly false and fabricated on his part.
Yep. And Lara,
I think
Lara's in CBS and
I thought it was I referred to the New York Times when they did their statement about their Iraq War coverage. I think it was a sorta culpa. You know, they waited until the end of it. It was, I think, all of 88 or 90 seconds. They didn't exactly say we're sorry that we got it wrong. They basically treated it as though they were issuing a correction on a story rather than understanding the utter severity of the misinformation that was put out.
I mean, they had – it was very poor from – I mean, I don't know this personally, but from what I read, it seems to be very poor reporting where there was an FBI report – I think I have this right – that where their source had stated his version of events to the FBI, and that was in contradiction to the version that they were broadcasting. And, you know, this is sort of like – I think this is sort of the conservative mirror image of what Dan Rather and the Bush
– the National Guard story.
I was just going to bring that up, and she was treated somewhat differently than he was when you come to the end of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a – well, I mean, they destroyed – I mean, it pretty much ended Rather's career in that world of establishment. I mean, Rather is still on the air in this Mark Cuban-funded television network that he's working on. And I saw him recently. I actually think Dan Rather's doing some of the best journalism of his life right now, but that really brought him down there. You know, 60 Minutes, I know producers there and people who have been producers there. I mean, they have incredibly – almost insane journalistic standards in terms of what ends up on the air. So for this to happen, I mean, heads should roll there. Given the quality of people they have producing that show, it was shocking that this happened.
I'm going to try to squeeze in one more call. Just mentioned Benghazi and that story, which has been ongoing for more than a year. Bring in Scott from Chesterfield. Scott, make it quick, though, would you?
The thing with Sylvester Brown, I mean, bosses come up with those kind of ethics things to cover up the real reason they fire people.
All right. Yeah, I thought you were going to talk about Benghazi, but... Bill, any further comment with regard to Sylvester Brown in that situation?
I was gone from the Post-Dispatch by the time that removal occurred. I guess I felt as though the Post-Dispatch editors were acting in good faith, and it wasn't just a cover. But I don't know personally.
We have 1 minute left. Let me ask each of you what your role is going to be in this conference, what you're going to be dealing with. Bill, go ahead.
So I'm going to talk about the reporters, whether or not we should have a national shield law to protect the reporters' privilege, and talk about my sort of schizophrenic view towards it as a journalist on one hand and a lawyer on the other.
Okay. Lance, how about you?
I'm going to talk about the fragmenting media landscape and the sort of decline of the audience, which we haven't really talked about, of the legacy press. I mean, the audience is graying rapidly for the legacy press. And the bigger problem I see is that young citizens are not really doing news as we have understood it, either advocacy news or the legacy news. So where's the young citizenry going to get its information? And this is a generational disconnect that I think we ought to focus on.
There is so much that we could have talked about during this hour. We needed more time, actually. But both folks can get a dose of all of that tomorrow. Go ahead, Jeremy. You're keynoting.
Yeah, I'm going to tell stories about some of the covert and overt wars that I've been covering that involve the U.S., the CIA, and other elite military units, and also talk about much of what we've been discussing today, whistleblowers, the war against journalism, not just in this country but around the world, and the fight for independent media.
That's happening tomorrow at UMSL, the Ethics of Politics and the Press, the public ethics conference being held at UMSL's Millennium Student Center from 8:30 to 4 p.m. in the afternoon, 4:40 p.m. Jeremy Scahill, great to meet you. We'll look forward to hearing you tomorrow. Lance Bennett, thank you for being with us from Washington. And Bill Frivolo, good to see you again.
And tomorrow on this program, we'll talk about the issues raised in two documentaries about the justice system, one looking at an innovative parole and probation program in eastern Missouri, another looking at the challenges faced by public defenders. Archive versions of the program are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.